Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 329. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. And we have with me today Jim Cassidy, who is an OPC minister who has been called by Providence OPC in Pflugerville, Texas, to plant a church in South Austin. Welcome back to the program, Jim. It's great to have you.
As always, good to be here, Camden. Thanks.
We also have with us Jeff Waddington, who is stated supply at Knox OPC in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Jeff.
Oh, it's always good to be with you guys.
Yeah, and we have a great episode lined up for us today. We're very excited to speak with Dr. Randall Peterson, who is a managing editor for the Westminster Theological Journal. He's working there out near Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Welcome to the program, Randy. It's great to have you.
It's great to be here.
Randy's written a dissertation titled Unity in Diversity, English Puritans and the Puritan Reformation, 1603 to 1689. It was written and defended at the University of Leiden in Netherlands, and we are very excited to speak with Randy today about this dissertation and about what it means to be a Puritan. It's a highly contested subject and one in which scholars have offered a whole host of different definitions and different methods for trying to determine exactly what a Puritan is, and we're going to get into that today and discuss Randy's approach and his innovative historical research here. But before we get into this dissertation, I should mention that Christ the Center is listener-supported. We do rely on the generous support of all of our listeners to help us produce and distribute all of our programs free of charge. Please visit us online today at reformedforum.org/donate. We need your help to be able to continue to do these programs, as well as a whole host of new initiatives that we would like to begin here in the springtime and on into the summer. But we need your help. Once again, at reformedforum.org/donate, we want to thank everybody for their support of everything we do here at Reformed Forum and this particular program, Christ the Center. We have an excellent here summary of this dissertation before us. I should mention that this book has been picked up and it will be published. It will come off embargo and be available for free, but not until May 7th, 2015 on the University of Leiden's open access website. But Randy, could you let people know about your publishing contract and where they might be able to see this book in the future?
The book was picked up to be included in the series. It's called Brill's Series in Church History. It's actually number 68. And you can actually go to the Brill website, and they're already advertising it. So you just go to the Brill's website and type in my name or type in Unity and Diversity, and then it will show up. They don't have a picture, like a book cover design yet, but that should be up pretty soon. So.
Great. Well, it's a high honor to be picked up by Brill, a very reputable publisher, and definitely this work is worth being included in that series. So people will be able to buy a copy in the near future, or perhaps pick one up at their academic library. I know Jeff is very interested in getting a copy of his own, right, Jeff?
Well, yes, I would be.
Yeah, it's a little bit outside of most people's budget.
Yeah, including mine, but
the retail price is $181. So,
well, it's an academic title, and that's not unusual.
No.
But we're hopefully going to condense, and Randy will be able to share with us many of the salient features, but as we open up this book, this dissertation, you will notice that it's definitely going to be worth the read. Randy, could you explain for us just the state of scholarship on identifying and defining what a Puritan is? I think some of our listeners might be unaware of this. I know many of them will be well familiar with the difficulty in defining a Puritan, but why has this been such a perennial issue in terms of determining what the boundaries are? Perhaps that's not even a good way to speak, but in terms of defining exactly what a 17th century English Puritan is?
Yeah, no, thanks. That's a great question. And, you know, the thing is like ever since the 17th century, even, you know, late 16th century, when, you know, the word Puritan first started to come into use, people had different ideas of what it meant and what it referred to. And historically, the word emerged as a term of slander in the, I think it's in the late or early 1560s or late 1550s. And so it was a term of slander given towards those who were wanting to pursue a further reformation of the English church. They weren't happy with the Elizabethan settlement, or in a settlement that was kind of seen as a compromise between what the emerging Puritan faction wanted, which was a further reformation according to the Bible and according to the, you know, biblical standards of how someone's doctrine and life is conformed. And then the sort of the halfway mark that the Elizabethan settlement came about proposing, which retained a lot of the ceremonies and things like that, that Puritans saw as a compromise, as an introduction of Catholicism and things like that. So you have that starting out in the 1550s, and then it sort of, as the movement evolves over the course of the 17th century, you have all these different people that kind of emerge with all these different ideas, and people that have been influenced by different aspects of Puritanism, and then scholars sort of were confused. Thomas Fuller, writing in the 17th century, said that, you know, if it were up to him, he would see the term banished from the historical record because it was just so confusing to find out, you know, what was a Puritan. I mean, you have, even today, you have people refer to, like William Perkins, a well-known Puritan, seen as the father of Puritanism. John Owen, referred to as a Puritan. But then also John Milton, whose theology was really anything but Puritan. And as, you know, Carl Truman has pointed out, Milton was kind of a quasi-Arian, you know. So in doctrine, he significantly departed from what we might call mainstream or mainstay Puritanism, but he still retains the title. And so kind of like, how do you sort through those issues? And different people, different scholars and historians ever since, you know, the 17th century have tried to do that, to try to trying to make sense of the movement. And then, so basically the background behind why I pursued my dissertation topping and sort of tapped into this whole subject was because there's, you know, within emerging scholarship now, people are starting to talk about Puritanisms in the plural. And it's not too different from people, you know, several years ago, and even I guess today, talking about the Reformations plural. So you have people like Carter Lindbergh, who talk about the European Reformations in contrast to the European Reformation. And then, you know, so he's writing against people like Scott Hendricks, who are talking about, no, there's just one Reformation and there's different branches of it. And then Lindbergh saying, no, there's multiple Reformations. And so this same thing is kind of emerging within Puritan scholarship about how there's all these different Puritanisms. And someone once said that there are many Puritanisms as there are Puritans. And so, you know, the question that I had, the question that I struggled with is like, you know, if we go that way in scholarship, if we dissect or break down or deconstruct the movement in that way, is something lost? Do we lose something in the process? And so that in itself relates to how we define Puritanism and how we pursue a definition. And so that's kind of like the background of what motivated me to even take up this topic in the first place.
I see. And it certainly is, based on the title, indicative here of how you're going to come down on this issue, or how we suggest we look at Puritanism in the singular, that there is a unity in diversity. Not only that there are similarities and differences, but the two come together in such a way that they do warrant the use of the term Puritanism as a single distinct thing, although a complex thing.
Right, right. And that's where Wittgenstein's concept of Familienähnlichkeit came into play.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Now, to engage in your historical analysis, you've actually chosen three English Puritans here. John Downame, Sir Francis Roos, is that correct?
Yeah.
Tobias Crisp. Now, what is significant about these three gentlemen, just initially, you know, who were they and why did you choose them as figures to demonstrate this unity and diversity?
There were basically two different paths when it came to historical method and scholarship that I could have chosen. And, you know, the one thing that I thought about was a method of looking at someone from each period within Puritanism. So like, you know, someone from the 16th century, someone from the early 17th century, someone from the the late 17th century. And so that would have been one way that I could have approached it, and an equally valid one, I think. But what I wanted to do, and as I started to look through this subject, is with the emerging tradition at Westminster and the whole concept of a confessionalization of Reformed theology, especially as it relates to Puritanism, I wanted to kind of look at people sort of like, you know, within this emerging tradition that were quite different and had different emphases. And so historically, you have, you know, people like John Downame, who was, you know, has been well known as a mainstream Puritan. And then people like Francis Roos, who has in the literature been called the first Puritan mystic. So his whole idea of mysticism and sort of pushing the boundaries of what would be acceptable sort of, you know, made me want to include him. And then also the fact that I did my THM thesis at Calvin on him. And then Tobias Crisp, who historically has been a very controversial figure because of his antinomism. And then, of course, his, you know, contested orthodoxy, you know, whether he was orthodox or not. And so looking at these three figures, you know, in my, as far as like method approach, I figured that, you know, if I start looking at their literature, start looking at their sermons and saying, you know, especially in their theology, you know, what similarities they might have, what differences they might have, is like, is there anything that sort of brings them together in spite of all the rhetoric, in spite of all the accusations that were sort of freely flowing within the 17th century, in sort of to try to get to the heart of the issue.
And then, as you already mentioned, you do bring in Wittgenstein's philosophical notion of Familienähnlichkeit, which just is German for family resemblance. But before we open up and really try to understand precisely how this family resemblance idea comes to bear upon these figures, could you describe somewhat of what you do in Chapter 2 regarding the 17th century background? What is significant about this background, and how does that help us understand your historical analysis?
Well, it's sort of, you know, when I was, you know, composing and writing the dissertation, you know, it came to the point where I was like, you know, like when readers, you know, like if I would have just started out with Chapter 3 and just gotten John Downey, people wouldn't have been able to put all these figures in their context. And what I wanted to do, my aspiration in writing this dissertation, whether I succeeded or failed, is something that others will decide. But I wanted to do both, you know, I guess, social history and intellectual history. And I kind of wanted to bring those together so that we can have a holistic portrait of the period and sort of pitch that as kind of like the way forward. So with Chapter 2, you know, going into the political, religious, and theological context, going into the early English Reformation, the Marian period, Elizabethan period. So basically just putting up the historical background, which sort of sets up the discussion of how we're going to approach these three figures and sort of piece it all together.
When the language of precisionism is used, can you fill out that word or, you know, explain what that means?
Yeah. And so, you know, looking at Chapter 2.3, which is the section which I talk about the theological strains within Puritanism, there are basically four prominent strains that you know, when we look at the Puritans in the 17th century, we can see there's the precisionism, there's mysticism, antinomism, and neonomism. And precisionism historically has been identified with, you know, mainstream Puritanism or the mainstream way of doing things. And then so, and that just kind of indicates, you know, the precise life, precise living, you know, being very minute with how you conduct and order your affairs, a strict Sabbath observance, for instance, and, you know, things like that. And then, you know, the mystical strain is sort of like focuses, you know, obviously on more mystical expressions of one's spirituality. And then antinomism gets into the whole question of the law and gospel And then neo-gnomism was kind of a response or a reaction to that. The thing to remember here is that, while I sort of, neatly separate these categories, in reality, they're not so neat and separate. And right. So often you have precisionists who are very mystical. You have, people that were antinomians that were mystical, and then you have neo-gnomians who were precisionists as well. So these categories kind of blend together. But when you look at a historical subject and when you write a dissertation and do scholarship, you have to have categories to even make an intelligent discussion. And so you have to do it, but you also have to nuance your language and then the concepts. So that's kind of, the approach that I took to this thing.
Before we delve into the three main gentlemen that you looked at, were there you mentioned Milton already as someone who's typically referred to as a Puritan whose theology doesn't fit the mainstream.
Right.
What would be some of the boundaries that a person, if they crossed it, could no longer be considered a Puritan? I assume you would use those four elements: the precisionism, mysticism, antinomism, and neo-gnomism. But apart from Milton, who else would have been might be thought of as a Puritan, but really doesn't fit?
Well, like Muggleton, Lodowick Muggleton,
okay,
is somebody within the literature that people often associate with Puritanism. And
this is not from a Harry Potter book. This is
historical figure. So Lodowick Muggleton, a lot of people look at him, and the interesting thing, and part of the thing that contributes to a lot of this confusion, is that a lot of the revolutionaries of the mid 17th century, where you have all these different factions that break out, like the Muggletonians, as they were called. Which, Muggleton was the founder of that group. They sort of carried elements of Puritanism with them, like piety and different, particular beliefs. And so a lot of people look at that and go, oh, look, they're very similar to Puritans. They're doing the same thing Puritans were, practically speaking, so they must be Puritans. And the interesting thing that a lot of people don't realize is that with Muggleton, he began his life, he began, when he started his religious journey as a Puritan. I mean, he attended the different congregations in London, heard different famous Puritan preachers preach, and he was well on his way to becoming a Puritan, and then he became disenfranchised with the movement, primarily because for him, it didn't resolve his crisis of conscience, his doubts. He was constantly fearing that he was going to hell, that he was predestined to be that he was a reprobate, all these things. And so the precisionist package or paradigm just didn't work out for him. And so he ended up leaving the movement and then kind of branching out into something else. But his formative years were within that movement. And so, of course, they're going to affect the rest of his life. Same thing with John Milton. John Milton, began as, a very strong Puritan writer, had very orthodox views, but then as time moved on, he sort of branched out and kind of departed from, his training and things like that. So they carried elements of Puritanism with them, but they finally, branched out beyond the movement. And so I guess historically speaking, there's different ways that you can look at this. You can define Puritanism in its mainstream expression as a strongly confessional movement, where there's a strong confessional impetus, which I do. And then you can see how there's Puritans that were sort of broke that boundary. They broke it by going beyond a confessional consensus. And I'm not just, talking necessarily about just the confessional consensus at Westminster, because there were obviously Puritans before Westminster, but Westminster was strongly a Puritan confessional movement, but it was crystallizing and putting in, in the form of words, what the tradition was up to that point. you know, when I started looking at, you know, John Downing, Francis Drewes, and Tobias Crisp, you know, the thing that really struck me was that these three individuals, even though historically within the literature they're doing different things, they're moving in different ways, doing different emphases, but even within these three figures, there's still a confessional knowledge. There's still a shared use of categories, a shared understanding of different concepts about justification and sanctification, the covenant, and all these things. Now, granted, in different degrees, but it's still there. So, you know, ultimately, I don't want to, you know, I guess, do the chicken before the egg, whatever. But what I come down to is that, you know, Puritanism in its mainstream expression has to be understood in terms of confessionality. And not just, you know, not just the kind of like rigid notions of confessionality that started to emerge in the 19th century, but a kind of a flexible confessionality within the 17th century, to where people like Francis Drewes, who was very mystical, got into a lot of the notions of the medieval mystical writers, but was also well received among his peers and even was a member of the Westminster Assembly, you know. And then, you know, people like Tobias Crisp, who was acute, even though his orthodoxy was contested, if you kind of strip away some of the rhetoric, there's still a confessionality that he was adhering to. I mean, he shared very similar concepts about obviously who God is, probably the strongest point of unity within these writers, but also about justification and sanctification and all these things. So I guess, you know, the thing in the, you know, within the literature, especially, you know, within current scholarship, you know, the idea is that people are looking at all these, the subject of Puritans and things like that, but they're not really looking at confessionality. They're kind of, you know, looking at all these differences, all these pluralisms, Puritanisms, but they're not really looking at a mainstream expression of Puritanism and how all these other, if you want to call it deviants, you know, the people that departed from that mainstream tradition, how their departure is kind of a response and a reaction to that mainstream tradition. So
I have a question, Randy, about the relationship between Puritanism and nonconformity. So for instance, as I come as a non-historian, somebody who's looking at this really as a layperson, and I'm hearing about the diversity that's there, and then what's defining what's outside the bounds, what keeps you in the bounds, etc. My and maybe you can you know, correct me or where I'm wrong, and then fill in where I'm lacking understanding. But when I think of Puritanism and the thing that holds them all together, is the idea of nonconformity or the idea of separation from the Church of England, and so I and issues of worship, not wanting to adhere to the laws concerning the Book of Common Prayer, etc.
Right.
So is Puritan, if you were talking about two circles, you know, concentric circles, what is the relationship then between nonconformity and Puritanism? Do they completely overlap, or is there some difference as well?
Well, I think if you're looking at two circles, you know, it's not like that they would be on top of each other, that you can just, you know, one-to-one correlation. So you kind of have to spread the circle apart to where, you know, there is overlap, but not necessarily so. I mean, case in point is the person who has been well known as the father of English Puritanism, William Perkins. He was an establishment man. You know, he was not a separatist. And, you know, different people, different, you know, historical figures who have been identified as Puritans, even, you know, mainstream Puritans, didn't separate from the church. And so especially in the beginning, you know, Puritanism was an inner movement of reform. And then, you know, as time progresses, you, of course, have more of an emerging nonconformist tradition in the later 17th century, where you have, you know, the Church of England is going in such a certain direction, being, I guess, infiltrated or infected, if you want to look at it from a theological perspective, infected from like Arminianism and things like that. And so, you know, the question is like, can we stay or do we have to go? You know, how far has the church gone? And is it, quote unquote, redeemable from within? Or do we have to separate and start something new? So I think, you know, identifying Puritanism with nonconformity isn't historically wrong, but you have to put it within the context of historical development. And you have to see it as sort of emerging more in the latter half of the 17th century than in preceding centuries, where there was still this concept and idea that the church can be renewed and reformed from within.
So, in other words, then Puritanism is very much an ecumenical type of a thing, where you've got Church of England Puritans early on, before you know, laws for conformity, et cetera, and persecution, and then you've got the nonconformists, which come in different forms, including, if I'm accurate here, and correct me where I'm wrong, Baptists, it would include Congregationalists, it would include as well Presbyterians. So it's very much an eclectic. There's a certain eclectic element to it. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the, in fact, you know, at my Viva in Leiden, you know, one of the first questions I was asked me is like, you know, they said, you know, you define Puritanism as sort of, you know, trying to tap into this Reformed confessionality, but what about Baptists? And of course the implication was that, you know, Baptists had no confessionality. And so, and then I said, well, that's, you know, that's a very interesting observation, but what about John Bunyan? And, you know, Bunyan was, you know, an uncontested Puritan, but he was also Baptistic. And so there has to be flexibility in our categories. You know, we can't just come up with a neat, rigid definition, and it has to be some fluidity to it. And that's why, you know, there's, you know, in the 17th century, there's more, I guess, flexibility with the bounds of a Reformed confessionality, to where certain people were actually within the bounds that, you know, maybe, you know, in later centuries, you know, they were more vilified and not seen as within the bounds, like Tobias Crisp, for instance.
Mm. I think that's where it's so helpful, where you bring in Ludwig Wittgenstein's theory of Familienähnlichkeit, or the family resemblance. And that's, an illustration many people can grasp or understand. If you think about a family, even where all its members have a very strong resemblance, none of them are identical to one another. And maybe three of the four family members have an identical nose, but the fourth doesn't.
Right.
But a different three have the same eyes, but one other person doesn't have those eyes, but he has the nose. And, you know, you could say, like, let's say all four of them share all the same qualities, but each of them are missing one of those qualities. Right. Nevertheless, there's still some bond, or there's still some unity, and I think that's yeah, where Wittgenstein's illustration and his philosophical notion of Familienähnlichkeit is so helpful here in Puritanism, because for almost all these Puritans, you can at least identify one thing. It doesn't right. seem to fit in with the rest of the group.
Right. And you know, the thing is that, you know, that's a very good observation, Ken, and that's exactly why I, you know, incorporated Wittgenstein's, you know, philosophical theory into this, is because, you know, like within these family members, you know, you have obviously different expressions, different emphases, you know, different nuances, but you have a core DNA,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so even though they might, like you said, have different noses or different ears or things like that,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you look at them, it's like, oh, you look just like your father.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so this idea that there's something that unites these Puritans, yeah, even admits their diversity, and at sometimes even great diversity.
Mm.
So, and that's just kind of like, you know, why I wanted to, you know, even approach this whole subject, and then the method that I chose.
Mm. Let's look at a few of these gentlemen with the three you've selected in a little more detail. so we can understand more of this family resemblance. The first we've mentioned is John Downame. His dates are 1571 to 1652. He's a Puritan clergyman who ministered in London, and he advocated that precisionist or strain of Puritanism. Can you tell us more about him and his history and how he uniquely demonstrates or instantiates? That's maybe a terrible philosophical way to talk about it, but how is he an instance of Puritan?
Well, Downame, when you look at Puritan literature, there's, what you can see kind of like a Puritan, I don't want to put it this way, but I guess it could, but kind of a Puritan canon. So there's a canon of Puritan literature or a standard literature where, these are mainstream Puritans doing the mainstream precisionist thing. And John Downame kind of embodies that, through several of his works, most notably The Christian's Warfare. He just sort of is, writing about the typical Puritan spiritual problems and things like that, and of course incorporating, Reformed Orthodox concepts and all these things as he goes. And so, one of the subjects that he deals with primarily in Christian Warfare, at least, is the issue of assurance of faith. And so, how do his parishioners, how do his readers come to an assurance of faith? And one of the way that you do that is through the discerning of marks and signs. So what you do is you sort of look at God's gracious actings within your life. Do you love to hear the word preached? Do you have love for the brethren? All these things that you sort of look at, and then you can sort of get encouragement and be encouraged in your faith by that God has graciously worked in your life. And then so that's sort of like a precisionist way of doing that, of kind of pursuing assurance. And so basically, I guess, as a mainstream writer, he's just, basically approaching the problems of Puritanism, on a parishioner or on a practical level in a very mainstream way. And so that's kind of what he's doing.
Tell us about Francis Roos. Now, let me just ask a question before you go into the specifics. But there was a Francis Rouse who was involved with putting together a Psalter. Is this gentleman related?
Yeah, it's the same guy.
Oh, okay. The pronunciation I've heard is Rouse. That's why I was wondering.
Talk about a family resemblance.
There's a rousing discussion.
There's the British pronunciation, and then there's the American Philadelphia pronunciation.
Oh, okay.
Water.
Yeah. So Roos or Rouse. I mean, even within the 17th century, like John Downame, for instance, his name is spelled in two different ways.
Yeah.
D O W N A M E, which I would pronounce as Downame, mm-hmm. and D O W N H A M, which kind of tends you towards Downam.
Yeah.
Or Downam.
Downam.
And so same thing with Roos or Rouse. It's, I guess, in the end, whatever floats your boat.
R-O-U-S for the listener.
R-O-U-S, yeah.
However you want.
Yeah.
So tell us, now his dates are 1579 to 1659. Tell us about him.
Yeah, Francis Rouse, basically, within the literature, he's been called the first Puritan mystic. And the reason why he's been called that is because he wrote a book called The Mystical Marriage, where he talks in very, highly mystical words and concepts, very elaborate language about the Christian's experience of mystical union with Christ. And, talking about all these sweet visitations and all these different things and about how, Christ comes at different times in a believer's life, and there's just this mystical fellowship that he has. But also, like as you noticed, Jeff, he was obviously very poetically minded and compiled the Psalter, which was approved by the Westminster Assembly for use in all the churches, and things like that. And he was a very theologically minded writer. He doesn't have any formal, theological education like Downame did. Downame studied theology, if I remember right, at the University of Cambridge. Roos actually studied for a career in the law, which kind of reminds you of Luther and Calvin anyway. But anyway, so he studied for a career in the law, and then he sort of had a mystical conversion experience, and it sort of put him on the path of, you know, religious studies. And so he became a devotional writer, but he never actually went to school for theology, or he was never ordained. Some people kind of mistakenly think that he was ordained, especially in the 17th century. Some people say that, but he wasn't. There's no evidence for that. But he had this strong, you know, mystical bent to him, this devotional bent. But he was also very orthodox minded, which is something that based on, you know, the literature that I read, you know, like from a secondary literature standpoint, I wasn't expecting. Of course, you know, being the first, you know, Puritan mystic is kind of big red flags for a lot of people. It's like, well, what does that mean, you know? And so you start looking into this, and it's like, well, actually, you know, there was a strong orthodoxy to him. And I guess that's probably possibly reflected in the fact that, you know, he was asked by Parliament to, you know, go to the Westminster Assembly and represent their cause. And so, and then in addition to that, you know, he had a very strong anti-Arminianism to him, and he believed that Arminianism was kind of like the Trojan horse in the church. And so, you know, this, when Arminianism infiltrates the church, it's a Trojan horse that you open up, and it sort of infiltrates and brings in Roman Catholicism and popery. And actually, you know, when you look at all these three different figures, Downame, Roos, and Crisp, there's, you know, one of the strongest common threads among them is an anti-popery. So, you know, somebody has kind of innovatively looked at Puritanism through the lens of anti-popery, which is kind of an interesting concept, and there's some historical merit to that. So his emphasis on, you know, mystical union and piety and all these things sort of, you know, give you a window into what he was thinking. And so he's kind of, you know, in addition to being known as the first Puritan mystic, he sort of developed a kind of bridal mysticism about, you know, the individual believer's union with Christ and things like that. So it's just a lot of different mystical piety and those types of concepts when you look at Roos, which is, you know, interestingly, it's something that a lot of Puritans, you know, obviously, most Puritans, you know, have similar, they have, you know, traditional concepts of mystical union and being united with Christ, but they often have like if you look at Richard Sibbes, it's more of a ecclesiastical reading. It's Christ union with his church, the bride being his church. And the different emphases that Roos is kind of picking up on is personal mystical union. And so the emphasis is on, you know, one's own experience of this mystical union as opposed to a churchly emphasis of union.
Roos and Downame both were very close to the confessional tradition, or at least trying to stay within the mores of the normative tradition, as you write.
Right.
But Crisp, here being the third, this is one of the points at which he differs from the family resemblance. What were Crisp's ideas, and why was he at odds a bit with the confession?
Well, you know, the thing is like when you look at Crisp, and you look at confessionality within Crisp, you know, you have to ask yourself, you know, historically, obviously, when did Crisp live and, you know, when did he die? Well, he was born in the year 1600 and he died in, you know, 1643 on the new calendar. And, you know, when was, you know, Westminster meeting?
Yeah.
You know,
years later.
It was later. And so, you know, historically, as a historian, you know, I mean, there's two different approaches, obviously, when you're looking at these types of concepts. You know, you can approach it as a theologian and approach it as a historian. And there isn't always a neat bifurcation between the two. But if you take a purely historical approach, you have to ask yourself questions like, you know, when did he live and when did the Reform Confessions at Westminster, were they drafted and things like that. And so you know, the question of confessionality within Crisp has to, since he died before Westminster came about, it has to be looking at the normative tradition that was in operation pre-Westminster. And so whether, you know, ultimately you come down with, you know, Crisp was confessional or he was not, you know, you have to look to see if there are any precedents for what he's doing. And so one of the concepts or doctrines, like if you look at his doctrine of justification, that kind of sets him apart from the mainstay of most Puritans, is that, you know, he believed in justification before faith. And so, you know, some people say that, well, Crisp believed in eternal justification. Well, not really. I mean, if you look at his writings, he nowhere says that justification occurs from eternity. He says that essentially he points justification to the occurrence at the time when Christ died on the cross, which is when Christ died, all the elect were justified. And then when they believe, you know, in time, that's the moment that is sort of applied to them. And interestingly enough, another point of difference between him and most Puritans is that at this moment in time where this justification is applied to them, it's sort of, I mean, the word application is kind of ambiguous in a sense, because for Crisp, it was just realizing that you were elect. So it's just coming to an assessment or an agreement that this was true all along. So it's not like bringing into something that wasn't before, but, you know, then again, you get into different theological concepts and categories. But, so you have a different nuance, different approach to justification, which interestingly has precedent within the mainstream tradition with people like William Twisp and even William Pemble, who Twisp placed justification from eternity, but Pemble placed it, you know, within time before faith, but not from eternity. And both Twisp and Pemble, interestingly enough, have never been accused of being an antinomian or of being non-confessionally minded. Even, you know, William Twist, as we know, or some people might not know, was like the first, how do you pronounce it?
Oh, prolocutor.
Prolocutor. Thank you, Jeff. Prolocutor at the Westminster Assembly. And he would have likely carried on with that task had he not died prematurely at that time. There's different approaches that different people take to these concepts. You have, you know, the mainstream where, you know, we're just talking about numbers now, where most Puritans go one way, and then there are still certain Puritans that are, you know, thinking in different categories, which, you know, we can't historically call that high Calvinism. I tend myself to avoid the term hyper-Calvinism, but, you know, kind of a high Calvinism, which, you know, deals with the concept of eternal justification and sort of an emphasis, some might say an overemphasis, on divine sovereignty, and, you know, things like that. So, but, you know, historically, you know, when people look at Crisp, you know, the thing that stands out is, you know, obviously his doctrine of justification, but also his concept of, you know, law and gospel and how, you know, what's the role of the law in the preaching ministry of the church? You know, and how are Christians supposed to respond to that? And then, you know, does the law, of course, have any practical use for Christians and how they conduct their life and things like that? And then, of course, you know, the whole issue of assurance of faith and how do we come to assurance of faith? You know, do we do it through a discerning of a marks and signs, or is there some other way to finding assurance? And for Crisp, there was a different way. And so, you know, in the literature, Theodore Bozeman wrote a book called The Precisionist Strain. But then, you know, within this book, he talks about the antinomian backlash. And so, you know, the precisionists were saying that, you know, the path to assurance and, you know, piety is, you know, this way. And antinomians were saying, no, we don't agree with that. It's a different way. And so, you know, there's just a different approach to the subject. But and then, of course, you know, when you look at these things, you can say, you know, are they totally different to where there's no family resemblance, or are there still family resemblances, and should they still be considered as Puritans? And I take the latter approach, obviously. So.
Yeah, and that's where you really bring things together in Chapter 7, where you start to develop and offer here a working definition or a suggestion in terms of what Puritanism is. Just in the summary of your dissertation, you say that Puritanism should be seen as a rather diverse conglomerate of tendencies with vying attitudes and priorities. And in this sense, Ludwig Wittgenstein's theory of Familienähnlichkeit is suggested as a helpful way to address the definition's problem and provide a better working definition for Puritanism. Can you flesh that out in terms of contrasting your suggestion here to other approaches that we've seen heretofore? Why is this approach really, how does this take the best of the deconstructionist and revisionist tendencies but avoid some of their failures and shortcomings?
Because, you know, the thing is, as, you know, historians, when you look at the subject, you know, we like neat definitions and categories. But historical reality is rarely, scarcely that way. I mean, even within our, even, you know, today, you know, people are very complex people. And so, or I should say, people are very complex. So, you know, if you look at politics, you know, someone can say and identify themselves as a Republican or a conservative, or even someone can say liberal or whatever, independent. But then when you sit down with them, at, you know, for coffee perhaps, and you start talking about some of their issues, and then you get to the point where it's like, you know, that really sounds like that you're more of a conservative yeah. for some liberals, or that you're more liberal than conservative, or things like that.
Well, so, that's where they have the rhino problem, like Republican in name only. But, I mean, at least with political parties, you have actual membership you could theoretically look at, or you could see how somebody registered. It's even more complicated in Puritanism, right? Because there isn't just a Puritan church that people were members of or ordained into.
Right. That's right. And that's a great difference between the two. And that makes the whole subject even more muddied, you know, to use that word. But basically you know, when you contrive or come up with a definition, you have to have an approach that, you know, gives due justice and due diligence to the mainstream tradition, to where most Puritans agreed upon, you know, their confessionality, whether, you know, it's a pre-Westminster development moving towards Westminster, sort of an emerging tradition. And then, or, you know, post-Westminster, where there's a strong confessional, and now it's in writing, you know, this is what, you know, most Puritans agree to. And even with that, there was some flexibility. And so if you look at the wording of the confessions at times, you know, there were specifically worded to exclude certain positions, obviously, but also to allow some variance in expression and articulation. So that, you know, people can unite around a confession and yet be a little bit different, you know. So you know, you just kind of have to look at the subject historically. So you have all these different figures, you know, and so, like, you know, how do you put it together? And that's why we're, you know, Wittgenstein's concept of family resemblance made most sense in the literature. You know, because otherwise, if you don't do that, if you don't come up with a way of looking at Puritanism that, you know, adequately concedes to, like, all these different expressions, then you're better off just kind of throwing out the term. And, you know, Carl Truman, actually, in his book on John Owen, the one that he published with Ashgate, you know, he talks about how, you know, the applying the word Puritan to John Owen, and how, you know, it's just there's too many historical problems that he, you know, he would rather just use the word Reformed Orthodox. And so that kind of actually spurred me on a little bit back in 2007 to kind of look at this issue even more, because, you know, if within the literature today you're starting to, you know, get hesitant about using the term Puritan towards people that have always been called Puritans, you know, then we kind of need to, quote unquote, redeem the term, you know, and sort of we need to recover this concept of a Reformed confessionality that is tied to Puritanism, while at the same time acknowledging the historical reality that there are quote-unquote Puritans who have no confessionality, that didn't subscribe to Westminster after the fact, had some relation to it, but often were either emerging out of that tradition and just got frustrated or disenfranchised with it, or, you know, went off into doing something totally new to where the word Puritan really doesn't apply anymore.
Randy, I have a question about perhaps modern day application of these three strands. It seems to me that we could look at the current modern day church, the Reformed church, let's say in our own context here in America, just as an example. Obviously, different lands, it's going to be, there are going to be different nuances of what's happening on the ground, as it were. But at least within our own land, do you see these three strands as strands that continued through the history of the Reformed Church? Did they break off at one time? Is it a thing exclusively of the past? Or do you see some resemblance to modern day debates and flavors of different communions and ecumenical relations and churches and such?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if you look at the Reformed Church today, there's a lot of diversity. And there are a lot of churches that are sort of known, you know, without naming names or going into it, there are, you know, Reformed churches or congregations or fellowships of people that are known for sort of going one way as opposed to another. So, you know, there are Reformed churches that are known for being more mystical and focusing more on, you know, mystical expressions of their faith. And then there are those that seem to be, you know, a throwback to precisionism, you know, very rigorous understandings of, you know, Sabbath observance and, you know, in things like that. And sort of, you know, even, you know, people that are just, you know, I don't know how else to put it, but kind of anti-culture, you know, and so, you know, sort of separatistic mindset. And then, you know, people that tend to be more focused on what you could call legalism or legalistic tendencies, and, you know, and things like that. And so I, you know, I think at the heart of the issue, these three or four strains are sort of, I guess you can say, incumbent within Reformed spirituality, Reformed sphere. Yeah. And so they sort of, you know, express themselves in different ways, you know, for a variety of reasons that are, you know, quite complex and would take a lot of time to figure out. But yeah, I do see it still happening today. And I see these strains, you know, having matured over the course of history and flowed in all different directions.
Sure. Do you think that there is a room within, let's say, one body, one, you know, denominational, let's say, body or affiliation, association, convention, or whatever you want to term you want to use, for all these various strands? Or do you think at one point or another, those strands always have to break or break with one another?
Well, interestingly, the way that it kind of plays out on a practical level is that, you know, there are different churches that are members of like a same denomination, for instance, that have a tendency and reputation to be known for different emphases. And so they can actually, you know, get a reputation for being more mystical, even within a single denomination. And I've seen that happen. And again, I'm not going to name names, but I know of places like that. But you know, the thing is like, again, like we talked about at the beginning, there's not as neat a bifurcation in these categories. So even within a single congregation, you know, you can have people that are more precisionist minded and then people that are more mystical minded. And, you know, they worship in the same congregation or even, you know, pastors in the same denomination. And even there's at times in people's lives where they tend to be more mystical than at other times, or more precisionist than at other times, and things like that. So, you know, it's a very complex thing. And we just kind of have to have an understanding of the complexity of human beings and our expression and the expression of our faith, even, you know, especially in our own historical development throughout our own life.
The more things change, the more they stay the same. In other words, we're talking actually about the human condition,
right?
Perhaps the fallen human condition.
Yeah.
But I like to note that this whole dissertation is a historical instantiation of the problem of the one and the many.
Yeah.
It's actually there was a gentleman that made that point. Renford Bambro, I think is his name. He also is not a Harry Potter character, who also applied Wittgenstein's Familienähnlichkeit to the problem of universals. So you're not alone, Jeff, in noticing that. You and Renford Bambro.
Oh, that's good. I'm in good company.
Just you
Muggleton. This is really fascinating, Randy. I'm looking forward to this getting published with Brill, and it's well-deserving. This has been such an important issue for so many years, and I'm not a Puritan expert by any stretch of the imagination, but at least in terms of my understanding, this is a fresh approach and one that makes perfect sense to me. I've found it very compelling and interesting, and I really appreciate the fact that you've brought this together, that you've defended this dissertation, and also that you've taken the time to join us today. Thanks so much, Randy.
Yeah, thank you. In my preface, if I might be able to read it,
please.
I say here that basically this book is a revised and expanded version of my doctoral thesis for Leiden University. It reflects on the perennial problem of studying Puritanism, that is, how Puritanism is best understood, classified, and defined. For centuries, historians have been perpetually perplexed over this issue, which has been compounded by varying political, philosophical, and cultural biases. While no historian is ever truly objective, we can and should strive towards objectivity and learn from and indeed improve upon those who have gone before us. G.R. Elton once quipped that the difference between real historians and amateurs is that the latter impose their enthusiasm upon the past, whereas the former wait for the past to suggest its own questions. Quentin Skinner put it this way: if we approach the past with a willingness to listen and with a commitment to trying to see things their way, we can hope to prevent ourselves from becoming too readily bewitched. And I basically said that I present my work here as not the final word on Puritanism, but as a possible way to move the discipline forward in more constructive ways.
Mm-hmm.
Had I chosen a less difficult topic, I could have been spared much vexation and agony, but also much joy would have been lost as well. And then I finally end the first paragraph with this, a quote from Elton, who was a famous historian. He said, "The future is dark, the present is burdensome, only the past, dead and finished, bears contemplation."
I thought that was Elton John. That was good.
Well, Randy certainly has spent much time with the Puritans. I do want to mention and encourage you to pick up a copy of Meet the Puritans. He's a co-editor of that title with Joel Beakey. He's also the editor of Daily Readings, The Puritans, and you can find both of those books online at wtsbooks.com. They'd be well worth your time, and certainly well worth the money for you to have a well-rounded and also a devotional understanding of the Puritans and their writings and their contributions to the church. Once again, we want to thank Randy Peterson for joining us, the managing editor of the Westminster Theological Journal. The dissertation titled Unity and Diversity, English Puritans and the Puritan Reformation, 1603 to 1689. Depending on when you're listening to this, it should be off embargo at the University of Leiden, May 7th, 2015, but we do encourage you also to find the book, which will be published with a slightly revised form by Brill. We also want to thank Jeff Waddington for joining us, Stated Supply at Knox OPC in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. You can find him online at knox-presbyterian.org, as well as feedingonchrist.com. Jim Cassidy, you can check out the church plant in South Austin coming up shortly. We'll have a link to that in the show notes as well, and you can find all of our programs and links to all the things we're up to at reformedforum.org. We encourage you to subscribe so that you get all these episodes downloaded automatically to your computer, and also to contact us if you have any suggestions or questions. A good way to do that is on Twitter at reformedforum, or through email, mail@reformedforum.org. We want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.